강이남 대대간자사 야나신남신남사야 락쇼제리담비나 알마인스리그르베이나무나 스리제탐냐르보비스탐다비타미르보쿠네 스와이암루파카다하얌 안티사바나시캄 Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pasaya Bhutale Srimati Bhakti Viranta Samani Nitri Namale Namaste Saraswati Deve Gauravani Patarine Deva Sesta Sundavari Paskacha Deva Tarine Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Hare Jagaraha Sivasati Kovandu Hare Krishna, 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 Hare 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 Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare 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 Krishna. I want to talk about some very obvious considerations. Sometimes things that have the most meaning in our lives, or things that can't have the most meaning. But things that are really accessible, things that we see but do not see. Sanskrit we say paschana vidya paschati. That one sees but do not see. We hear but do not hear. But the reality is present. There are many things like that. Because of the fact that we are so much codifying based on immediate senses and how they respond to things. And we codify things so much based on heredity and environmental considerations. And of course we codify based on aspirations and seeing what the fads are. But it didn't necessarily allow us to really access what we really see but do not respond to. So when you visit Hare Krishna temples, one of the first things you hear many times is about that you're not the body, that there is a higher existence, there's a higher kingdom, there's a greater essence to life beyond the physical, that we're really spiritual entities. And we never can hear that too much, because the significant thing is not just hearing it, but realizing it. You can have intellectual, philosophical knowledge about many things. And that kind of goes around in mental gymnastics. But realization is a different matter. You can have gyan, but vigyan, you have knowledge, information, but realization is different. So sometimes realization becomes more established as we are able to scrutinize things in a more applied sense. We're able to remove some of the coverings that normally obfuscate our ability to have a greater sense of appreciation. Bhagavad Gita, there's a verse, that never was there a time when one did not exist. That there are times when our particular physical costume was different. Because now we're in male bodies, female bodies, we're in white bodies, black bodies, Indian bodies, Chinese bodies. Something we're carrying at this time. We've carried many, many different things in the past. There is a story in the Srimad Bhagavatam, very, very ancient scriptures. One of the most ancient scriptures on the entire planet. And it not only deals with what's has happened and will happen on this planet, but on other planets, other universes even. And it's a story about one Brahmin named Ajamil. Like today you were having some discussions amongst the Brahmins. Brahmin is like a priest, man or woman who has been ordained to officiate, to bring in certain special blessings into the environment by acting on a certain level to be able to access those blessings. And in ancient times, there was great, people took great shelter of what is called samskaras, of various types of rituals. The rituals were designed to produce many, many auspicious things. someone would marry, when someone would make birth into the child of the world, when someone would have various kind of anniversaries of things happening in their life. There would be a great potency from Brahmins being able to give blessings to that and to give guidance about how to maximize the benefit of such. So, the Brahminical class is to help to hold back so much of negativity, the individual and society to the planet. And the Brahminical class has a duty to bring in divine interventions. You've heard since time immemorial about angels and archangels and fairies and demigods and things like that. These are not just figments of the imagination. They're figments now for the common man's or woman's imagination because it's beyond their grasp of realization. But therefore it becomes like mythological. Many things now we call, we categorize mythology because it doesn't go into our limited or irrational perception. And irrational perception is simply based on the kind of patterns that we're normally used to programming and how we codify. Nothing so wonderful about that. So Adivil, he was such a Brahmin. He was trained very astutely. He was very aware of how to bring in benediction for the elders. He was very aware of the demigods, were very aware of the responsibilities of, that one has in giving reference and honor and praise and not interfering with. He understood so much about life after death. He understood so much about the atma, about the soul. He knew so much about transmigration, so many things. He was aware of great spiritual scriptures, engaged in great bhajans, kirtans, spiritual songs that bring in blessings and that access to the mercy from God. Married, had an interesting family, a nice parentage. And one day, he was very young, his 20s, 20, 21 or so, and he was asked to go to a village to do some errand for his father. He lived a rather sheltered life, quite spiritually, quite sheltered. And so in the process, he came upon two people seemingly rather in a debauching situation. That they were drunkards, the man and the woman. And they were actively engaged in illicit activities. And the lady was a prostitute. And the man was quite degraded himself. And Adivil became very captivated by the sensual exchanges that were going on. And his mind became so disturbed that he just practically froze and just observed and watched and looked. It's like today people are so much sensually agitated. They so much want to experience but also want to see. Like pornography is one of the biggest growth industries. It's very dangerous because where there is active pornography, there is crime, more crime. There is so much minimization, family life. There is more interest in gratification rather than accommodation and commitment. It brings in unwanted progeny. It's so much degrades, especially women folk. And it puts so much of life on a platform of machines interacting, somehow trying to get some stimulation by any means necessary. I wouldn't say what it does even to children, because so much child pornography is also there. And it causes many people to act upon some of the things that they see. So in those days, there was no business of pornography. Matter of fact, not even the bulletin boards we see these days. You go to some of the big cities, New York and other places, even the signs on the buses, the subways, sometimes what we would have called pornography just 10 years ago. Some of the things in the newspapers we call pornography. And some papers actually have pornography. Like the other time I was mentioning to you when I first met Nelson Mandela, one of the first things I mentioned was I was just shocked about the degraded daily newspaper. I counted at least 4 counts of pornography just in the regular newspaper. And there was in the ad section, like you have the ad section here in America, and it's advertising, selling houses or people selling items or people looking for jobs. So in the ad section, there was prostitutes, you know, would actually solicit companies, organizations. And it would happen, and so if you want Asian girl, Indian girl, black girl, white girl, etc., your house, our facility. And this is common newspaper. So I was emphasizing how such things will increase degradation, meaningful. So in Roger Mills' time, there was no such kind of newspaper, no newspapers at all, and no bulletin boards advertising jeans or advertising underwear or other things, or even a car, anything, I suppose, being advertised just in a central way, or to say of the more exaggerated things, or Playboy magazines and things of this nature, X-rated movies people take advantage of. So, for him, it was shocking just to see two people in the open, just engaged in such sensuous expressions. Because where there's culture, not only do people not pursue such things, but they would never enact in public in such ways. No highly spiritual, cultural person would want to have the person who they care about or love or pursuing to do such things in the public, because it's far from any sense of nobility or sense of caring or sense of righteousness of consciousness. It's actually animalistic. Animals, they function so much based on instinct, even though they have some intelligence, but they do so many things based on instinct. And so it's not a surprise to see animals in the streets or in the bush engage in open sex life and sensory gratification. It's so-called natural. But to see humans in such ways, so-called humans, then that, of course, is not really accessing the human platform, because one is just being motivated, pulled, controlled, dominated, a slave to their senses. So this was like so shocking for Ajahn Mill that he became very disturbed. So much to the point that after he left the scene, he just kept on meditating on that prostitute, what was going on. She was clothes were coming off, and he was doing different things. They became so much disturbed. But disturbed in a way of thinking, what that must be like, what she must be like. And even though he had nice family, even though he had good background, even though he had so much knowledge, this information about certain things, he did not have realization about the dangers of allowing the mind and senses to go wild. And the dangers that happens to one who follows through on just the passions without some higher ethics or some higher strength to regulate it, to control it. So he literally became so affected that later he went to pursue that very same person. He had her to come into his home as a maid, as a servant. And as she was there in the house, his mind became so agitated, his senses so disturbed, that he kept finding ways to act upon his passions. To the point that the prostitute then took over for the wife. He dismissed the wife. He had a tension by this prostitute. So once he started submitting to illicit sex, all of his good qualities, one after another, thrown out. Because then his greatest interest was simply about satisfying his personal desire. Responsibility, accountability. He was even previously taking care of his elderly parents, who had so much previously arranged his care. But he lost his interest. He had no desire to maintain a chaste wife. What to say of the effect it had on his children? Because nowadays, people enter into a relationship with the idea that divorce is always possible and ready to turn to it or ready to leave one partner for another partner very, very quick. Because they're so much influenced by that kind of atmosphere. And because so much is accepted and so much it goes on more than not. And even people don't feel so much compunction about illicit activities. Sometimes partners say, well, just as long as I don't know about what my spouse is doing, just don't let me know about it. Even though they suspect many things, see evidence of many things, but I just don't want to know, I don't want to see it. The business goes on, as usual. So, what happened then? Ajami went on his whole life in that direction. As he was so much now captured by the passions and had a total mind shift without realizing how he was codifying everything differently based on the desires of the prostitute, fulfilling the whole relationship that was engendered from them. And so, at some point, that's what happens to everybody, he became very sick. And death came. And so he was in a very interesting state. Sometimes one experiences a coma. And a coma is often a deliberation where there is an evaluation of the person's previous thoughts and activities to make some decision about what will be the ultimate outcome of that entity. That means looking at the credits and the debits, looking at the pious and pious activities, weighing these things, decisions to be made. Sometimes we see someone who's in a coma and they come out of it and live for a while longer. People have the near-death experiences. It has tremendous effects in different ways. Some people are given a little more time to process some things, to work some things out. Make some types of adjustments. Many people, they change their whole lives after having that experience because it is so traumatic of what they begin to realize. So, Ajamil, he actually saw the attendance of death. The Vedic scriptures explain very distinctly. Most ancient cultures it mentions about how there is some deliberation that goes on, some processing that happens before the soul goes to its next designation. I'm just coming recently from a little tour of Chicago, New York, Denver, Arizona. In Arizona, I had a meeting with a group of judges and lawyers. And I was explaining to them some things about metaphysical and spiritual law. And at some point, I was emphasizing about what happens to the soul at time of death. And I was explaining how when the soul leaves the body, how it goes to a court, like a court. And how there is litigation, arbitration, about what will be the penalty, the chastisement, what are the rewards accordingly to the activity. And so these are actually personalities who work on behalf of God who do these sort of things. So the Vedic scriptures define the Supreme Court justice of such as Yamaraj. It's called by different names, different traditions. So Yamaraj, he's actually a pure representative of God. He's not just an executioner, or not just somebody who's just keeping records. But he's really a pure servant and does his job quite expertly and has attendants to come fulfill his job. So his assistants are the agents of death. Sometimes the people have heavy nightmares. They're often reflecting back to some of the experiences they had when they were being snatched out of some of their previous bodies, or they were in association with some of these entities. Sometimes when people have certain altered states of awareness, they have some perception of these entities. So they're most wretched, because their duty is to arrange and process it. But they only come for certain types of personalities who have been actively involved in sinful life. It is in no way that everybody experiences the same thing at the time of death. Not at all. Just as people live in different kinds of houses, drive different kinds of cars, have different mentalities, the time of death people experience all kinds of different things according to the patterns of their karma, or the patterns of their thoughts and their actions. So some souls, they literally are snatched. The soul and astral body is snatched out of the physical body. You know, some people, when they die, they pass urine, they pass stool, they have horrified expressions on their faces. You just go to a funeral home. You look at the different facial expressions. You don't have to be a spiritualist, a mystic, or a psychic. Look at the expressions. Or if you visit a mortuary, you see the difference. Expression sometimes is still focused on the physiognomy, the face. Some people smile. It's a smile. The time of death comes, it is smiling because the soul needs. The other people, they're screaming, they're yelling, they're grabbing, knocking, they're passing stool, they're passing urine, they're biting, they're contorting, and the soul goes. First, the soul leads differently according to the consciousness also. Some people, the soul leads to the anus. Some people, it leads to the mouth, according to the quality of consciousness. Leads differently, it goes. So, in cases where someone's been very sinful, as they are having some slight awareness of what is ahead of them, they're horrified. And so the Yamadutas, they actually have to escort the person out. They snatch the, they come, it's like they snatch or grab, so on. So this was Ajamil's fate. Remember, he had become very sinful. He was in all kinds of sinful things. He became a drunkard himself as well, along with all the other sins. So he's lying on his deathbed, and these Yamadutas are hovering over the bed, discussing and making arrangements to snatch his soul out. But then all of a sudden, some angelic beings called Vishnu Dutas, they appear. And they started discussing with the Yamadutas. And they're telling the Yamadutas, no, this entity is not for your, not your property. And they're, first they're astounded because they know about all the sins that he's been engaged in. And they do their job well. So they're kind of wondering who these very beautiful beings who have come interfering with their sins. So there's a discussion to go. So later these Yamadutas, they go to Yamaraj, and they inquire because they're thinking Yamaraj is pretty much the supreme. They're wondering, who is this responsible for interfering with our service to you? Who are these entities? And on what grounds, what right do they have to do this with this particular person, especially? But as the soul was leaving the body, Ajamil, who was very attached to one of his kids, his son called Narayan, and he was screaming out the name, calling Narayan with great, great intensity. Narayan is also another name for God. Now, because at the time of death, so many thoughts, actions, and previous pious and spiritual activities were embedded in his consciousness, and the desperation that he was experiencing and the intensity of calling out his son began to access so many of his previous critics and totally affected the conscious, made a conscious shift to the point that it was enough for him to be able to, what is it, bring out or use so much of his pious credits. See, everything we do, we are crediting and debiting. So because previously he had done, up to his 21 years old, he had done so many devotional things, very dedicatedly, very meticulously. It wasn't that those things were thrown away, even though he put them on hold by his captivation, they were still part of his eternal bank account. So in our own lives, there is this balancing that's constantly going on. Sometimes we find how people deal with death differently, isn't it? Sometimes people feel, die, she's rather than not educated. It's like in Africa, it's considered that as long as you are remembered, you live on. And so it's important to have family to remember you, to make rituals every anniversary of your death. It's important to have people to have your picture and to offer flowers and things to you from time to time, to speak about you, because then you live on. You live on as you are reflected, your actions and thoughts and deeds are reflected. So here in this case, it explains in Bhagavatam how one can have a son who can liberate them, or a daughter who can liberate them. The Sanskrit name for that, the son can be liberator. Of course, the son can add to your downfall also by karmic connection. So, the Ajamil, while he was in that state of coma, once he was liberated by the Yamadutas, they stopped the Vishnu Dutas from taking him, and they allowed the soul to go back into the body and for him to regain consciousness. Like when people have near-death experiences, they come back into the body with a certain awareness. Some people become totally different persons. Some people now, they have so much realization about so many things. Now he remembered, just as when you are not only in coma, but even when you are under anesthesia, although your conscious mind does not recall, your subconscious mind is a sensitive and attuned to what goes on. Many times, doctors and nurses kill their patients not by the medical performance, but just by some of the conversations that go on in the operating theater. That we know people are affected by their constitution, that some people have a very weak will to live. And in their hearing as the operation is going on, looks like this person is not going to make it through, this is happening, this is going on. Or they're hearing vulgarities, or there's so much lower energy in the room, it can affect, especially borderline cases. Where such patients are hypnotized, you take somebody who's taking an operation, you have a good therapist who hypnotizes the person. They can help that individual to remember the things that they experienced when they were in the operating room, because their impressions are still in the subconscious mind. Or what to say, even the baby is in the womb, the entity is aware of things that are going on in the environment. And that, in the first part, the major part of the personality begins to be formulated even before the child comes out. What to say of those first formative years? So then Ajamil, he carried back those conversations. And of course he made a total life shift. And later, the Vishnu Dutas sent a carrier to come in to take him back to the spiritual kingdom. So a couple of points. First point is, in our own lives, we should always be in a reflection, simple reflection, but a deep reflection, that we have to lead. And so we should be clear about our associations, that they're quality associations. And now we take out insurance, life insurance, on our husband, on our wife, on our children, with the idea that something's going to happen eventually. And we want to be a little prepared for it. But do we think, some of us perhaps do, that one day I am not going to have the same kind of relationships that I have now? Who's going to take care of my son? Who's going to take care of my daughter? Who's going to take care of my husband? Who's going to take care of my wife? Who's going to associate with them when I am gone? One day I am going to leave, one day they're going to leave. What's going to happen to my house? What's going to happen to my car? What's going to happen to my job? What's going to happen is that things are going to go on. Whether you're there or not there, things are still going to go on. Because life is going to go on. But sometimes we're thinking that it can only happen with us. But sometimes we're thinking that we're always going to be there and they're always going to be there. No. One day, you will not be there with your girlfriend or boyfriend or husband or wife. One day, you're not going to be there for your brother or sister. One day, you're not going to be there for your son, for your daughter. And one day, they're not going to be there for you. How have we arranged things in our lives, considering that's going to be the case? What level of experiences have we had so that when we no longer are in association, we don't lament and think about that I should have done this and why I didn't do this? But most people, that will be their case. They will be lamenting so much, thinking that they should have done something different. Some cases now of the super rich, the rich, so they meet death, somebody in the family meets death, and they freeze the person with the idea that soon they're going to find a cure for the disease and they're going to bring that person back. In many cases, after a while, they dismiss putting money into this situation. Or some people are thinking that somehow their money and their power and their prestige can somehow help them to avoid the inevitable. But it doesn't matter. Whether we're young, whether we're old, whether we're healthy, whether we're rich, whether we're this, that inevitability is, of course, there. In the book that we have coming out, there is one of the mindsets. It's about, consider that you have left the body and you are looking back in retrospect at your life, at your environment. What would you see? What things would you reflect on and wish you had done differently? You leave this body, how would you want people to think about you after you're gone? Based on how you're living now, people are going to think certain ways about you. It's going to be their ongoing last thoughts about the kind of person that you were or that you weren't. Even those who are part of your immediate circle or your relatives, they're going to think a certain way about you based on what you did and what you didn't do. I mean, now we're constantly looking at how we should have did something different. Should have went to a different school. We should have waited a little later before we started involving ourselves in certain activities. Now we got 5 kids, 6 kids. We wish we would have started a little later. Now we're liking this job. We wish we would have taken another job. Now we bought this house. We wish we would have bought another house. So many things we do is so much based on, I wish I would have thought it out a little deeper. I wish I would have made some additional considerations before allowing my senses to respond in that particular way. But in so many of those things, it's too late now. Because that's an ongoing part of our existence, our reality. I wish I would have saw that those attributes in that man. I should have saw that earlier. I wish I would have studied that woman a little closer before I made that commitment. I wish I would have considered a little closer the kind of car that I bought, about what my needs were. But I bought it, and now I'm stuck with it. I wish I'd been a little more careful before I took that recreational drug. Before I should have been more considerate about refraining from alcohol. Now I'm an alcoholic, and I'm a drug addict. It was looking back, thinking what they did and how they should have done differently. You go from person to person, you think, most people, this is how they're thinking. I should have did this thing. If I had to do it over again, look at many significant things in your life, if you think if you had to do it over again, you would have done so many things differently. And we've been telling ourselves that for many lifetimes. We can look at our last 10 lives and we'll see so many things that we have done, and many things we're doing again, we're repeating. Huh? And people fall into some of the same kind of patterns. Huh? It's an accident that some people have the same type of problems. They keep connecting with the same kind of men, same kind of women. They keep finding the same kind of problems on their job. One job after job after another job. Is that an accident? It's something about them that keeps connecting and drawing such things to them. And unfortunately, it can go on for lifetimes. If we don't take a closer look at how we codify and how we perceive and how we respond to things. So now in Mill's case, his life was a very good life previously. That we are constantly feel accountable for and are happy with. And as we have to leave this body, we don't have to reflect back and think that I should have did this. I didn't do this thing and I should have. Because that kind of meditation and talk has been going on lifetime after lifetime. It happens so much in this life. And we see many things that we're now involved in, that if we had to do it again differently, we would have done it differently. So many serious things that happen in our lives, that just some small inattentiveness has now led us down a certain path that we are now held accountable for. So many people now are drug addicts, and some recreational drug, taking some alcohol, some situation started, and now it's become a pattern. There are hundreds of thousands of women all over the country now who are having abortions. Some interaction that they wish they would have not involved themselves in, and now they have some responsibility that they're not ready to be responsible for. Every single person who died last year, going to die tomorrow, next year, who has AIDS and other types of diseases of that nature, is looking back and thinking, in so many cases, how they should have done something differently. And now, they are slowly dying through the suffering process from the disease or have died. So, is God so cruel that little accident, and he makes someone suffer perpetually for it? No. The Judeo-Christian conception that you go to hell and you burn forever? No. Or that even by one mistake? No. A mistake is an aggregate based on consciousness that now allows that particular thing to be a catalyst that it makes a certain thing happen. We say accidental. Something happens by accident. Not really. There's a whole line of thoughts and actions, reflections that produce that, and now allow the thing to come about. God is not so unfair. You know. Krishna is most compassionate, greater. His mercy is even greater than his law. But something becomes the stimulant or the catalyst that arranges for now a certain scheme of activities to begin to prevail. And so as we do things too mechanically, without trying to look closer to see what ramifications and implications are, then we will be very disturbed later. Now what's important is that today, tomorrow, next week, we have a chance to make a difference about what our future is going to be. And what things later are going to be so much a part of our lives based on the decisions that we tune into. So some people, by decisions they're going to make in the next few months, is going to mean death for them. Some is going to mean disease. Some is going to mean bankruptcy. All kinds of things. In other cases, something auspicious. But we all have within us, we have that power to make the decision and then going to determine what the consequence is going to be. We have a very difficult relationship now, a marital relationship. We have made certain decisions that has allowed that union to exist. If we may have some difficulties on our job, difficulties in other environments, something about us, some decisions we've made, some use or abuse of free will has then brought this on. So be very careful about what decisions that we make. To be very careful about how we process and codify every interaction. And we should constantly try to see, as we do something, that we are ready to be fully responsible. One of the ways we do it is that we live, not that we live in a morbid sense, but we live every day with the great adventure and the great excitement that each action is action we're offering to God, we're offering to Guru. And every day becomes another wonderful chance to make another offering and a wonderful experience that we have another day to be able to glorify the Lord again. So each day becomes more and more chance to engage in glorification and spiritual activities. Other than another day, we get more incarcerated by the sinful activities and entangled in the things that we do or have done that now produces some negative or inauspicious results. So, just reflect on the story of Ajahn Mill. It's given to us in Bhagavatam for our benefit. You know the dynamics of what happens when the soul leaves the body. Also understand the bank account, spiritual bank account arrangements. How we have some credits, we have some debits, how they balance, how they counteract. Understand that what we do is being monitored, being recorded, being evaluated. That we're never alone, that we're always being watched, helped. We're ready to receive that help. And to know that the transition from this body to the next is not just some conceptual thing, but it's an actual higher reality that is there that everyone will experience. And last, to look at our relationships and to consider that sometime in the near future, we're not going to have that same association as we now have. Will we be ready and will they be ready? Those who we're now with, will they be ready when we're no longer around? And will we be ready when they're no longer around? And when we go, when they go, where do we go? And that is all based on who is going to come for us, what our bidding will be. I was mentioning how, I think 2 weeks ago, just recently I lost another one of my devotees in Africa. And so I was just thinking how many dozens or so devotees, disciples have left their body. And so, and in more than 90% of the cases, it was very abrupt. It's overnight. One case, accident. Other cases, very abrupt. And so as devotees, we hear about these things. We hear, we read constantly. But also as devotees, how much are we ready? We have to make that shift. And if our consciousness is mature and grounded, then becomes. Very wonderful exchange. And if not, then we also look back and think, why did we not do something different? Hare Krishna. So if there's any questions or comments? It's not that Hare Krishna philosophy, Krishna movement, so much about morbid considerations. But we, from time to time, reflect on the idea of transmigration, reincarnation, because where there's action, there's corresponding reaction. It's not always on the exact moment that you get the reaction. Sometimes it's in the near future, sometimes it's in the far future. And so the soul is experiencing things, immediate environment, and also in the future, based on the aggregate of our desires and our actions.
Now just hold them back.
Anyone have a question? How many of us have already kind of thought very deeply that when we leave this body, how people are going to think about us? Our relatives, our friends, associates, what things are going to be saying, you know? You can leave the body and you can look back. What people may be saying about you may not be exactly what you anticipated. Or how much what you leave back could be okay with the fact that you've left it behind.
Thank you for the class. This morning I had a client, patient, 90 years of age, and had never discussed anything about religion or spirituality. And so someone came in and offered her a bulletin and asked her, was she ready to accept Jesus? And she didn't know what they were talking about at all. She's 90. And Wednesday they're going to start taking care of her property. And just sitting there watching this really got me sort of thinking about what you were just speaking about.
Is she seen now?
She is very deranged at this point, but very rich, have lived 90 years, and I just looked at it and I just felt so sorry. But I started chanting, and sure enough, like you said, when I went in and took her, she started to expelling. So, but she understood something, that she had nowhere to go and all. And Wednesday they're asking me to help dispose of all of the accumulations, clothes and everything. But she just doesn't have any idea now, after all this time.
Interesting about what happens, you know, with mature nature, because there's so many people who put their whole life in developing mature assets. And they get old, and they just see everything falling apart with themselves. And then as soon as they leave the body, then their estates often auction off, and everything's gone. We explained that the other day, how, you know, we had some chance, we moved to this house, we went to some estate sales, and it was quite revealing. These, you know, beautiful mansions, somebody dies, and then the younger kids, they're arguing over everything, they decide to sell everything, you know, take the money. So you have everything in the house, everything in the mansion, tag. As soon as the hour, you know, sometimes the newspaper, they have 8, 9 o'clock, 7:30, when the auction opens up. I'm sorry, when the sale opens up. And so people will be lined up in front of the house. As soon as the door opens, everyone runs in because they know that, you know, you get the first picks, you get the best things. And you'll see people going in and going out. And they're carrying things. And sometimes in less than a day, the whole house is cleared up. So here's somebody spent their whole life in accumulating all kinds of, you know, wonderful things that they worked so hard for. And then in 24 hours, everything in here is going right out. Someone else who's getting it real cheap, taking their favorite things, their sacred things, and it's all gone. The children just count the money. my father, he left the body when he was 92 years old. And he was so preoccupied with death. And I remember we were very small. We would go to church, and then he would take us, our Sunday entertainment was going to funeral homes. He would leave church, we'd go to a restaurant, eat something, and then we would go by a funeral home. And he would look at people and look kind of, oh, such a young one. he would read the obituary. You know, he would just see the study, he would go from, you know, casket to casket, you know. And we were small, we were just, you know, little kids, 4 or 5 years old, and we were running around in funeral homes. Oh, my daddy was watching, looking at the caskets. And then we got to have it looking also, thinking, wonder how they up with the head. And, you know, so preoccupied. And when he left the body, he had arranged everything. He had already picked out his casket. He had already arranged everything. You know, now you can get a package for everything for your funeral. You know, what kind of flowers you want, what sort of music you want to be played, how you want the casket to show, have it open, when to close it. You know, he had everything all arranged, you know. All I had to do was just, I appreciated the arrangement. I just had to go to the funeral home, get this, the contract, everything was already arranged. But at the same time, he lived in such a way that he didn't want to live forever. And he was very healthy. He didn't start showing any signs of weakness until he was about 90 years old. Mm-hmm. He was still painting his own house, driving his own car, and doing everything. Then in the last 2 years, his body just shifted in real fast. Any other comments or questions?
One time I was helping some devotees with a magazine at New Vrindavan, and I had the opportunity to listen to a man who had a near-death experience, Howard Storm. He was a university professor, and he said he wasn't an atheist, but that he just was kind of like a cynic, and that he felt he listened to people who had contact with, say, higher experiences, but he just felt that it could never happen to him. But anyway, he told his story, and the bottom line was he went through all kinds of, when he left the body, you know, he had a near-death experience, and he left his body, and he went through very hellish kinds of experiences until he reached the point where he heard a voice, and it said, "Pray now." And even when he heard that voice, he heard it, but he didn't hear it. He didn't act on it because he had no previous training. Or let's put it this way. He said he couldn't remember any previous training. He didn't even know how to pray. And then he was going through even more hellish experiences, and he heard that voice again. And then some bits and pieces of information came from his background. And he began to call on, you know, Jesus, because that was the only training he had. But his whole experience began to shift. And then he goes on to tell the story of how, through that experience, he connected with higher angelic beings, or angelic-like beings, and they began to help him understand what he went through and was going through, and then how he eventually came back into his body. And it was very interesting. After he came back into his body, the experience, he said, had been so powerful that he didn't even want to be here. And it took him about a year to reintegrate. And in that reintegration process is when he met the devotees and began to discuss with the devotees his experience. And he was helped, he said, by the devotees because they had scriptural references that kind of reflected what he had been through. And his whole point, I think, was the point that you were making, was that that now every day to him is a new day, and that he could go at any moment, and that he needed to completely, at the end of a day, completely review his life as the angels reviewed his life, and clear away any misgivings or misunderstandings or misconceptions that he had about the nature of his life and his connection with God. So,
There's so many examples. Once I was telling about the case of a devotee who was distributing books at Chicago Airport, and this gentleman just kind of, you know, brushed by, and a girl was showing him from the fifth canto of Bhagavatam. It shows some of it shows the story of Ajamil and the Yamadutas snatching him. And so then he left. A couple of weeks he came back. He was looking for that same girl in the airport. When he found her, then he was very frantic, you know. And he asked her some questions about the book that she had showed him. And he told her that when he was away, that he had something like a heart attack. And she practically died. And while he was in that state, that he saw those entities that she had showed him in the book. And he was like so eager to try to find out more. What are they? What is this? She was talking to him, and she had showed him some things. She was talking about life after death, and she had showed him this book. And it has a picture of this personality I mentioned, Ajamil, and these Yamadutas coming for him. And they look like monsters, you know, wretched. But he was saying how he saw those same kind of beings while he was in that kind of coma state. And he was very eager to, you know, buy the book. Any other comments for it?
Haribol Maharaj, you had you talked about people thinking about things they could have done, should have done, shouldn't have done, that sort of thing. And I think obviously everybody has some of that. And even though we might push past it and you know, just go on just because we have no other choice, how do we get rid of that? If it continues to interfere with us, you know, we realize we're moving on, but still those thoughts are there. How do we actually replace it rather than just, you know, forcing it away?
It's a matter of seriously organizing our priorities. Like I was saying, how we are going to have some shift. And what's going to happen? The things are going to go on. But then, how are they going? The way they were going? We can make some determination about that now. About how we set things in motion, you know, based on that. So we should just see that that's an appointment that every single person has. And we have it soon. And so we want to be able to be in the best situation, best condition, when we have to have that appointment.
I don't know if I should mention this or not, but I'm sure, Srila Kripapat, you remember the meeting I had with you about a year before I received the transplant. And my wife and I had gone to Srila Kripapat, and I was very ill, you know, very close to leaving the body. And I had a lot of misgivings about receiving a heart transplant. So at that time, I wasn't convinced that it was something that I wanted to do. So I had gone to Srila Kripapat, my wife and I, and had told him that I decided that I didn't want to take a heart transplant, that I was tired of the suffering that I've been going through, and I was prepared to make my transition. Well, subsequently, Krishna arranged other things, and I did receive the heart transplant over 3.5 years ago, and it gave me an opportunity to involve myself in more service. But the point I wanted to make is this, that at the time, Srila Kripapat said, well, I can't make any decision for you, but whatever decision you make, I'll be with you. And if you decide, you know, to make the transition, I'll be there to help you make the transition. And at that time, you know, I just felt like very comforted and very, in a sense, very like happy almost, you know. And my question is exactly if you can tell us exactly what can or does a spiritual master do to help his devotee or maybe someone else make that transition from life to death?
It's like a lawyer. You have different types of lawyers. They have different areas of expertise, different areas of potency, different abilities to be at the case. So, according to the quality of spiritual master is to act as a transcendental lawyer. And according to the quality of spiritual master can can be distinctly aware of every single disciple who leaves the body and has the responsibility to arrange where that next soul goes.
Heshul Kishpat is not exactly on the topic that we discussed today, but it's kind of related in the sense that I was talking to some people recently, and they were talking about the movie Independence Day, and there was another movie before that, Arrival. And in every case that they talked about the movies, and then it went back into the book about the guy who, I forgot the name of the book, he was kidnapped by people or something. Abduction. Yeah, something like that. But in every case, the beings that they dealt with were always hideous, along the lines of Rakshasas or the Yamadutas, etc., etc. But then, and according to Bhagavatam, in everywhere except perhaps the place of Rakshasas, etc., the beings are on high heavenly planets are generally very beautiful. Even as described, the beings who live in the earth and Nagaland are very beautiful. So, whatever phenomenon is being experienced here, is it more of that Rakshasas and demons and stuff? Because it doesn't seem to be the beings that we're reading about in Bhagavatam, so the heavenly planets and stuff.
Some people are having experiences with higher entities, but most of that stuff you hear about, like the the communion book and these the greys, they call them, these are not evolved beings at all. In Bhagavatam, it describes the qualities, the characteristics, you know, of evolved beings, and these are not evolved beings. Evolved in the sense, see, sometimes we have a misconception about what hellish planets are. Hellish planets sometimes is just very gross in suffering and limited sense gratification. But sometimes there's some hellish planets that are, there's not so much, say, distinct suffering, but there's a grossness in that there is serious absence about the God connection. And there is the technology or luxury that would seem to be that of a higher heavenly kingdom. It's just like, you know, you have sometimes somebody who's a sinful person and they live, you know, very impoverished. You have some people who are very, very sinful and they live in a very opulent way, but they're very sinful. And in both cases, they're sinful. So some entities are coming out of atmospheres that have some sense of advanced technology, metaphysical and so-called physical. But they're lower beings. They are sinful entities, in a sense. Or they are not pious entities. Struggling so much for survival,
etc. It seems as though the media, because that's what you basically is, they're trying to frighten us, basically by showing us the communion and the Yamaduta type personalities that come to this planet, rather than showing us the higher personalities that are available. So that if anything comes like that, then we're immediately frightened. Our consciousness is lowered rather than heightened. And I'm certain they know about the positive entities, but they want to continue to lower our consciousness by showing us the negative entities. And I always tell myself, well, he says he already knows. But when we see stuff like that, movies like that, we remind him, hey, listen, they're not all like that. They're more positive beings than what we see here on the screen.
There's always been traffic coming in and out of this universe. And there's always been ability for higher entities, especially before the presence of Lord Buddha, to come. But entities come according to the atmosphere. It's like why the demigods don't appear vividly, or high entities don't come in so much, because the atmosphere is so contaminated. So then most of what's coming is entities that will feel comfortable with the atmosphere. We should not be surprised, and more we're hearing about such, and that they seem to be, you know, manipulative and whatnot.
Swami Krishnapad, could you give me your view on Dr. Kevorkian?
On?
Dr. Kevorkian, the one that's taking people out.
The one who's taking, the doctor who's, they call that
assisted death.
Assisted death? Is that another term for it? It's nothing new. Once he's being more honest than some practitioners. There's so many people who are dying who are being assisted. It's happened in so many cases of people who lost the desire to live, and the families or they themselves arrange with their doctors for such. I mean, as there is more emphasis that the body is just a matter of interactions of chemicals and cells and et cetera, et cetera, and less there's anything about quality of life for people who are experiencing deeper loving relationships and fulfillment, then we'll see all kinds of arrangements for who lives and who dies and what organs are being used. And, I mean, obviously, there's a big, big international business of human spare parts. Big business even in America, spare parts. And so, obviously, you know, money and power talks. So we'll see more and more of exploitation and capitalization and manipulation based on where the money is and where the power is. That is to be expected. Any last points?
Srila Krishnapad, I have kind of a comment, and that was what I'm kind of concerned about is with the time I have left, utilizing it to the best of my ability. And a friend of mine had said, well, you know, in your 40s, you know, you may not be able to think you accomplish a lot, but wait till you get to 50. Like, you know, you really don't accomplish as much as you get older. And, like, what I've noticed is if I'm focused and clear, then I can, you know, if I'm clear about my goal and focused on that goal. And I guess my comment is when you gave us the time management suggestions, one of the ones that I want to do more, I think it's most helpful, is where you review your life goals every, I think, week. I mean, it's like really frequent. And it seems to me that that would help me to have more clarity and more focus in terms of getting what I need to accomplish, you know, done in the time I have left.
Yeah, everyone, because if we don't, like the African proverb, you don't know where you're going, you know, any road will do. So there's a tendency that the average person is just doing things, you know, by the moment, based on, you know, the gratifications or whatever things are imposed upon them, and never really having a chance to be proactive, always reactive. You know, involved, you're always so much involved in trying to rectify or adjust things without really being able to, you know, to initiate and to direct. Anyone who's successful in anything have to have some focus, some vision, and be able to act upon that vision. So what the sages and scriptures, we don't want to just move based on the environment, because the karma of the environment is very degrading. We just move based on the environment. We'll just be dragged and slaves, you know, of the environment. And the transcendence will be beyond that by having higher vision, higher goals, and then some strategy of how, you know, how to attain those goals. And we take one or two more, then we'll have RT. Anything else in the back there? Question? Our goals should reflect on our goals in such a way that, again, that we can leave this world and feel happy and good about what we did, what we accomplished, what we, you know, how we used the time that we were in these bodies. And not have to work out certain things because we didn't fulfill what this human existence was about. These are carryovers that go from lifetime to lifetime. Whatever stuff you're most attached to, whatever you put your greatest energies into, you expect more of that in the future. That is the nature of karma. So think about the story. I think it's a simple story. It's a very simple discussion today. Sometimes it's good for us to backtrack and look a little closer at what's happening in our lives and how much we're on top of things. And if, in fact, we are doing things that we can feel proud about, we can be responsible for.